What's today? What's today's date? 28?
So it's March 28th, 2009 in Auckland. Evening program.
Important. I'm really, really excited about having Mother Umala here to speak to us. I think if there were so many Ram Nomi programs going on all over the world, we would have a lot more people. But just the same, we're recording this, like we record all these interviews with very, very special devotees, so that we can just keep that. You know, there's so much information and so many stories that will be lost if people don't record these kind of conversations that we're going to be having. It's very informal. Now, just to tell you a little bit about Umala, I dived into some websites and things to find out a bit more about her to share with you. But Umala joined the ISKCON in 1973 in Chicago. You can correct me if the website's telling wrong information. So her primary work has been in the area of education. As you can see, she's that's why she's very tired tonight, because she's been doing a lot of work for Prana today. So that's why we're having a little earlier than normal. In 1982 and 83, she and her husband started an ISKCON primary school in Michigan. And she served there as principal for 8 years.
Sounds right. Something like that.
Right. She also went on to found another primary and secondary school in North Carolina in 1990. She's compiled it's called Vaikuntha Children?
Yes.
Is that the name of it?
That's the name.
A guidebook for education in ISKCON. She's very well educated with a master's degree in
school administration.
She's also for many years written on the education column for ISKCON's Back to Gaurdji magazine, where she's also an associate editor. And when I first read an article by Umala, I was so impressed, and it was quite a number of years ago, and it was about bringing up children.
It was a long time ago.
It was such an amazing article. It was just that one story that just had her stuck in my mind. You know, I've never met her or seen her or even heard that much about her, but that one really struck me as and I followed her, and just to give you an example of the sort of work she's doing for Back to Godhead, because that's my association with her before I met her in Auckland, is I just love these articles, and if anyone would like a copy of them, she's done like these two, the most recent, aren't they? Water and Air.
They're fairly recent. There's one on deaf education, which is also pretty recent.
Oh, okay. So these are really wonderful articles, and I just enjoy them so much, and got a lot out of
them. We're getting fire and earth coming.
Great.
And I'm working on ether.
Ether as well. So Umala's very, very intelligent, very knowledgeable. While I've got you all here, just to remind you that she's doing the seminar tomorrow morning and continuing on for, I'm not sure, three more weeks seminar on the nectar of instruction. And I so enjoyed last week's class. It was just so informative and fun, actually. She's a very good teacher, and she made it fun and interesting. It's a very serious subject matter, but I find humour makes it stick in my brain. So she uses all her abilities to teach and humour to get the message across to us. So that's all very wonderful. She's just.
I thought this was going to be a short introduction.
No. There's too much to say about you, Emma. Because we just want to get to know you better. So now, would you like to just briefly tell us about the new children's books?
If I knew you were going to ask that, I would have brought them with me.
Oh.
When I could have given you a demo.
That would have been good.
Well, there's a lot of Krishna conscious books. Yes, thank you so much. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Oh, perfect. There's a lot of Krishna conscious books that have been written for children. In fact, I was spending today going through dozens and dozens and dozens of them. But there's been very, very few that have been put together by people who understood scientifically how to make a book for different levels of reading ability. So you'll find a book where the illustrations are geared for very young children, but the vocabulary is geared for older children. It's not just simplifying the story. It's looking at how many lines do you have per page, what words you're using, how long each of your sentences are, how complex each of your sentences are, how complicated the concepts are, what is the match between the text and the illustration. And because very few people have had training like that, we find books where it's mixed up. So the vocabulary might be suitable for a 6-year-old, but the sentence structure is suitable for a 12-year-old. And the result of that is that the books are not very accessible. It's not very enjoyable to read a book that's sort of not really a fit. And there's been a few attempts, maybe 3 or 4 attempts, to make a series of children's books that actually teach reading, where each book is designed very scientifically and where each book is a little bit harder. You know, whenever you're learning anything, you have to start with something simple. You can't go in the kitchen and just cook the whole feast. Okay, you've never cooked before, you know, you've never made porridge, you've never made pasta, and okay, tomorrow you're in charge of the kitchen and you've got to cook, you know, the Gopinima feast. So that's, you've got to start with something easy, like rice, and then after you've mastered rice, then you can maybe make some dal, and after you've mastered rice and dal, you can make a simple sabji, and you kind of add on to it, right? So it's the same way with reading. You first learn a few letters and a few sounds, and then you have to add on to that, and you have to add very gradually. So a few devotees have made some attempts at this, but we never had a complete program to teach children how to read. And my main interest is producing not just things for children, but educational materials, so that eventually our schools, like the one here, could, if they wanted to, right now you can't even if you want to, but could if they wanted to, have all of their materials centered around Krishna. So you're learning how to read, your mathematics, your science, your geography, your history, everything from a Krishna conscious point of view. And at least in America now, because in America there's a strong separation between government and religion, which is not true in much of the rest of the world, the government schools there are, I'd say, anti-God. They're not even neutral in terms of religion. They're anti-religion. And they make sure there's nothing religious anywhere. There's no mention of God, no mention of religion. And in response to that, there's a number of Christian publishers that have come out with, you know, math from a Christian perspective, and science from a Christian perspective, and literature from a Christian perspective. And you can get maybe 6 or 7 publishing companies that will give you an entire range of educational books from ages 2 through 18 and even university level, from, and not just a Christian perspective, but a Mennonite or Presbyterian or Catholic. So that's the kind of thing that I would like to do. Because right now, if you want to teach your child in Krishna consciousness, you've got to use materials that are really opposed to what you're teaching. And then you have to try to Krishnaize them. And that's pretty hard. If you're teaching your kids, you don't really have time to sit down and say, all right, let me see how to make this Krishna conscious. You spending all your energy, you know, your own sadhana, your own family, preparing for your classes and correcting papers, and you really don't have the energy to put a whole lot of Krishna consciousness into what you're doing. And then on top of that, in many of our schools, we have teachers who aren't even fully trained in Krishna consciousness. So how in the world are they going to bring that in, or what to speak of the parents who are homeschooling? That's a very long explanation, but that's what I'm working on. And it was suggested to me by Anuttama Prabhu of ISKCON Communications that, because the job I want to do is very big, he said, take one thing that can be done in a reasonably short amount of time and that would stand by itself as a complete project. He said, then even if you can't do anything else, still it would be something of value, rather than doing a little of this and a little of that and a little of that, none of which ever gets finished.
It would be a completed work. It would
be a completed work, and he said, then other people, he said, even if that's all you ever get done, other people can take that and build on it and be inspired by that. So I took that to heart, and then I was asked by Sitaram Prabhu in the manor specifically to write children's books, because I had a number of different things I could have started on. So I started on that. And of course, it ended up, like many things in this material world, to be much more complicated than, about 100 times more complicated than I had thought it would be at first. But it sort of runs away with you. But we've produced 42 books. They're in the six have been printed as just a short test run, and all 42 books are in production. And what I'm working on right now are the teacher's guides and the activity books. And before I can do that, I have to make sure that the framework is perfect. I hope this is interesting to all of you. Okay. For example, you know, you start off teaching double L. So you say, okay, we use words with double L, like all, ball, call. No, you can't do that, because when you first learn A, it sounds like ah, but all doesn't sound like ow. It's not ow, bow, cow. It's all, ball, call. So you can't use those words at first. You have to teach first the ah words, and then you can teach the ah words. And the same when you're teaching double L, and if you want to use full and bull and pull, well, you can't use those words, because the U has a different sound. The main sound is an like bus or butt. And if you have full, it really would be, you know, like bus, it would be would be full or bull or pull, but it's not. So you have to look at each word and think, and then you have to think, okay, well, that's how I say it in America. I was speaking to one of the devotees here from the UK, and he was talking about something at the bottom of the page, which I would call a footer, and he calls it a footer. He said, we put the footer. But so you have to try to figure all this out, because you can't teach the children, okay, this is a sound that a U makes, and then immediately introduce the exceptions. Do you understand? So Prabhupada talks about this. He says how English is different from Sanskrit. In English, there's but and put. You know, dull and full. It should be dull and full. So calculating all this, and then sometimes I've used a word because I thought it was all right, and then I think about it, and wait a minute, no, that doesn't fit. And adjusting all of it and getting it in the right order. Or to and go. Now, you can teach to and do together, but you can't teach to and go together. It's too confusing. So you teach to and do, and then maybe a couple weeks later you can introduce go. Is that?
Very complicated.
Yes, it's very complicated. And that's just the phonics. That's not even the other things like sentence complexity and concept complexity and what kind of font you use. And so that's what I'm working on. And I'm hoping that we can produce something that is top-notch quality professional on every level. Professional in terms of the way we're teaching how to read professional in terms of the illustration, the layout, the printing, all of that kind of thing, and also really top quality in terms of the spiritual content. So we're having, of course, a lot of stories about Krishna, but also a lot of moral stories, a number of stories that Prabhupada tells. We've made little stories of that. And one of the most exciting things in the book, if we're able to raise enough money to do this, is that there's a new technology called sound spots, where there's almost invisible dots put in a book, and you put a special device over the dots, and you hear the book out loud.
Really?
So we're doing this, Krishna willing, in altogether, including English, 27 languages, which means you have the book, and you put this device over it, and it reads the book in English, and it'll read the book in Russian, and read it in French, and read it in Hindi. And the benefit of that is that otherwise you have to print 200 German books and 200 Slovakian books and 200 Slovenian books and 300 Italian books, because not everybody can read English. But this way, even though the books are printed in English, people can hear it in their own language. And the other benefit of that is that adults all over the world, the adult devotees, can now use these books to learn how to read English. Because otherwise, without an English teacher, how would they be able to do it? But because they can hear the books read in English and hear them read in their own language, they should be able to use it to read English. And then additionally, if you have, you know, your Gujarati family and grandmother's there and she doesn't know how to read English, but she'd like to tell the story to her grandchildren so she can hear it in Gujarati, and that way she can know what the story is to tell it. So that's what I'm working on, and that is a part of the whole curriculum project. As I say, ultimately I hope to have all subjects, and the curriculum project is 1/8 of the learning to read is about 1/100 of the curriculum project, and the curriculum project is 1/8 of the whole project to create a school system for the Hare Krishna movement. Something like if you want to open a Radio Shack store, you go to the headquarters, you get training how to be a Radio Shack administrator, you get the Radio Shack products, you get a whole package, and you just, I don't know if you call it here, plug and play. You know, plug and play. It's all ready. You just plug it in and press play. So if you want to start a temple in the Hare Krishna movement, you have a lot of guidance from the GBC and the other temple presidents. There's sort of a formula. There's a template how to do it. But if you want to start a school in the Hare Krishna movement, there's nothing. Good luck. You know, you're on your own. So there should be a whole school system, which is, of course, what Prabhupada envisioned with the ministry, where you come and you get training how to be a school administrator, you get training how to be a teacher. Not just a teacher, but a Hare Krishna teacher. You get all the materials. You get support along the way. You get help dealing with the parents. You get help with the community. Whatever you need. You get funding. That would be nice, huh? Get money. I want to open a school. We need, you know, $10,000 to open a school. You can apply for a grant. So that would be a whole system. So that's ultimately...
Right.
What I'd like to see. So if we do a few grains of sand now, then maybe the whole building, the whole thing will get built someday.
Well, somehow it started with the end of the story.
Was that the end of the story?
That's what you're doing now. We'd love to hear your whole story.
That's nice. How many millions of lifetimes back do I have to go? Well, once I was with Krishna in the spiritual world.
We could start with
that's that. Like the Jed Barrett story in the Bhagavatam. You know, you hear all those different lives. It goes way back to the beginning.
Where would you like to start? Just before you came to
Krishna? Probably think it's always good to start with today and forget the past that sleeps and ne'er the future dream at all, but bear with times that are with thee and progress thee shall call, Bhaktivinoda says. You've got to tell me something specific. I mean, what do you want to know?
Before you came to Krishna consciousness, where did you come from?
I was even more pathetic than I am now.
So you were born in the States.
I was born in the States, right down the street from Devan Ritchaswami.
Really? Wow.
Although I didn't know him when I was growing up. But, you know. We just recently found out that we were neighbors. Yeah.
And whereabouts is that?
In Manhattan, in New York City.
Oh, in New York. Okay.
Well, not just New York, Manhattan. Can't get better than that.
What was it like growing up in New York?
Well, I grew up right across from Central Park, so I got to go to the park all the time. And New York is a very open-minded place. There's people there from all over the world. Every culture, every ethnicity, every religion, everything. So you're basically open-minded in New York or you don't survive. And it's a very, it's a place where there's a lot of museums and opera, that kind of place. So that's what it was like. I went to, I'd say the most significant things as far as now, this is the school my parents sent me to from the time I was about two or three until I was seven, was what's called an experimental school. And the children, sounds terrible, huh? He starts laughing. No, it wasn't like, you know, Mengele in the concentration camps. It wasn't that kind of experiment. Hare Krishna. Anyway, it was a school where each kid could learn on their at their own pace. We weren't all taught in a group. And they did a lot of things which now are is considered cutting edge, best practice in education, but at the time was very controversial. And I was taught to read with phonics at that point in time. Most kids were taught sight reading. We did science with all experiments. I basically loved school. I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to go on vacation. I thought it was great. And we could each work at our own pace and in our own way. It was very individual. Then after that, we had a summer house in New Jersey in the country. After that, there were some problems in my father's business. And we moved to New Jersey, where I was put in a state school. And I hated it, to put it mildly. I really just hated it. So I was already reading fluently, and they put me in a reading group with people, you know, see Jane run, see Dick run, see Spot run, run Spot run. And I would come home crying every day. And when I sat in that classroom at 8 years old, I actually forgot about this for a long time, then, you know, Super Soul reminded me. But when I was eight, I remember sitting in the classroom and I said, I promise when I grow up, I'm going to change education in the world. And I'm going to make learning fun for kids. And that was an important part, I think, of my experience. Then also, growing up in New York, I used to see Indian ladies in saris sometimes. You know, until 1965, there was almost no immigration allowed in America from India.
Oh, okay.
That was, I mean, Prabhupada coming to America in 65, it would have been difficult for him to have spent much time in America before that. Indians can only come pretty much as tourists. There were. Right. That's why when Prabhupada came to America, there was not one Hindu temple anywhere. But anyway, I definitely saw some Indians on the street, and when I was eight, I decided that I believed in reincarnation, which was pretty interesting because I didn't know anybody who believed in reincarnation, just, you know, what I read about in the encyclopedia. And when I was nine, I told my mother I wanted to wear a sari. So she had one friend who'd been to India, so she bought some cloth. It was that color. And she, like, sewed. You ever seen one of those sewn saris? They're like a skirt with a... Like, anyway, it was like that. And I used to have maps of India on my wall and little, you know, those little dolls they sell in tourist shops. You ever seen those little Indian dolls? Anyway, I had those all over my room. And what else could I tell you about when I was little? When I was four, I told my mother that I wanted to find God.
When you were four?
When I was four. I was in the living room. She was on the couch. My family was Jewish. My father was the head of a big multinational food company, selling, you know, specifically Jewish food. I said, I want to find God. I asked my mother, why are we Jewish? She said, because my mother's Jewish. I said, why is she Jewish? She said, because her mother's Jewish. I said, that's not good. You have to do something because it's true, not just because your mother does it. So I was kind of a rebellious kid. And I had a lot of training in Judaism. I went to a lot of Hebrew school. My sister moved to Israel when I was one. My sisters were teenagers when I was born. Oh, what else can I tell you?
So, how old were you when you met the devotees?
In person, when I was 14, but I first had contact with Krishna consciousness when I was 12.
Okay.
So my sister, I had one sister who moved to Israel, and another sister, neither of them are living anymore. My other sister, they're both married, lived on the Lower East Side, maybe two blocks from 26th Second Avenue. And her husband, who I still keep up with to some extent, was very active in sort of the beginnings of the hippie movement. He helped produce a publication called The Village Voice, which I don't know if you're familiar, there was an article about Prabhupada in there. They were just sort of part of the scene. And I didn't find out till years later that he had met Prabhupada on 26th Second Avenue a number of times. Anyway, I would go to visit them at least once a week, sometimes two or three times a week. And there was a shop there called the Krishna Store that was run by Alan Coleman, who was the one who had recorded the Happening album of Srila Prabhupada. So if you've read in Leelamrita, and I'm sure you've heard the recording, if you heard it, you'd immediately recognize it. So it's one side is just chanting Hare Krishna with all sorts of interesting instruments. And the other side is the Guru Vastika. So Mr. Coleman wanted to sell the record. That was why he made it, to sell it and make money. So he's playing this record in his shop over and over and over and over again. And he was selling Indian clothes, dresses, and especially stuff with mirrors, you know, the dresses and cholis with mirrors, and bridge basti posters of Vishnu and Krishna. So I would just wander around. I don't know, my family was very liberal. I mean, now it sounds funny that you let a 12-year-old girl wander around the Lower East Side by herself, but also we weren't so fearful then. It was a different time.
Wasn't as much crime?
I don't know. The mood wasn't so fearful.
Yeah.
I mean, I would ride my bicycle alone every night. Never thought twice about it. Anyway, I would regularly go to the shop and just listen to this record of Prabhupada chanting. I never bought anything in the shop. So that was my first contact, was hearing Prabhupada chanting on the record. And do you want the whole story? I don't know how interested. Are you guys interested in the whole story? It's a long story.
And the end?
The end?
No.
The answer.
That was when you were 12?
That was when I was 12. And then I used to listen to the radio every morning while I was getting ready for school. And one morning I heard the Govinda that we play every morning, because George Harrison had produced it. It was playing on the radio. And, you know, on the radio, either before or after a song, they say who it's by. You know, this is such and such song by such and such group. But I missed it. I didn't get to hear who produced the song. I thought, I got to get that song. So I started listening to the radio just constantly, you know, every time I was home. I heard it one more time. I was by the Radha Krishna temple, right? So I write it down. And then I had a dream that I owned every record. You all know what a record is? I don't even know what it is. Like a CD, but it's bigger and you put it in a record player, you know, anyway. So that I owned every record in the world except for that one. I was looking for it everywhere. And then I finally went to New York to the biggest record shop and I asked if they had it. Anyway, I got it. And it had a list of temples in it. And it had the painting that was on the cover of Krishna Book Volume 1 and 2. So Krishna Book Volume 1 with Radha and Krishna with their arms around each other with like that big cape. And Volume 2 is Nathji, which, to somebody who doesn't know who Nathji was, it was a completely incomprehensible picture. What is this picture? Anyway, I cut them out and I put them on my wall. And I would listen to the record album. And then one day in secondary school, at the library, I saw a boy reading Krishna book, which had the same picture on it of Radha and Krishna. And I knew this boy's name, but I didn't really know him, just one of the kids in the school. I said, "Hey, Bill, I got that picture on my wall that's on that book. Can I look at the book?" And he says, "Sure." So I'm looking at the book, just looking at all the pictures, you know, and then I give it back to him. And as I give it back to him, he said, "Would you like to come with me to the temple?" Temple? What temple? I didn't make any association between my hearing the record and the Krishna shop, the song, the record, and the book, and the temple. And no one had heard of the Hare Krishna movement, and it was unknown. I said, "Sure, you'll go to the temple." I was kind of an adventurous sort of person. If you can't already tell that about me. Anyway, I remember just saying to my parents, "Okay, I'm going to go with this boy to the temple." They said, "Do you know him?" I said, "No." I don't even think I knew his last name. You know. "Where is this temple? What kind of temple?" I said, "I don't know." Anyway, I was about 14 then. So we visited the temple in New York. And Jadarani was there. She preached to me for maybe 2 hours. And as I was leaving, I turned to this boy and said, "You know, I agree with everything she said." And he said, "Well, could you explain it?" I said, "No, I couldn't repeat any of it, but it made a lot of sense." I went back one more week. And this time, we talked to another girl. And I said, "What do I have to do to join?" And she must have thought I was with this boy. I think devotees in general, if we see, you know, man and woman together, we think they're together. And you can't, you know, I was like 14. But you can't always tell how old, especially a girl, is. She said, "Well, we don't have any room in the temple. You'd have to get your own apartment." You know, thinking, get my own apartment? Live with my parents? I'm going to school. She didn't tell me follow the principles, chant Hare Krishna, nothing. She just said, get your own apartment. So after that, I decided I believed in Hare Krishna, but I didn't go back to a temple for years after that. I bought Easy Journey to Other Planets. I thought it was about astral traveling and stuff. You know, read a couple pages and decided it wasn't what I was interested in and put it down. So that was about it. And then, of course, I was listening to the record and I would sing along with the record. Then when I was 17, I went to university. And I had thought that spiritual life meant to merge with God. That was my idea, that, you know, you become one with God. So I was doing my own kind of meditation and trying to lose my identity. Now I have a little bit more understanding of what I was actually doing. At the time, I didn't know what I was doing at all. I was actually playing with, it was dangerous, what I was doing, the kind of meditation I was doing. I didn't know that. Anyway, at one point, I felt like I was losing my identity. I actually felt like I was going to be, you know, merge. And I became very frightened. I just immediately stopped what I was doing. And then I decided that I didn't want to lose my identity. I didn't want to become one with God, that it was something awful. And because I thought that was spiritual life, I decided that I didn't really want spiritual life. And I thought, well, I guess I want to be a materialist. So I tried that for a couple months. And after a couple months, I started praying. I don't know who you are. I said the basic prayer of Judaism, the Shema, and I said the Lord's Prayer, which is the main prayer that Jesus taught. And then I said Hare Krishna, and I said, I don't know, you know. And I said, chanted the Maha Mantra. I said, I don't know who you are, but whoever you are, you got to save me. And then I ended up finding Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is, lying on the floor of my best friend's boyfriend's room. And I said, oh, isn't that the Hare Krishna book? And he said, yeah. I said, can I borrow it? And he said, sure. And so I took it back to my room, and I'm just reading. And I said, oh, this is what I want. That's what I'm looking for. And then that, I can't talk about seasons here. That winter, which is your summer, my university had a work program because it was too cold to go to school. in Vermont, if you know anything about American geography. So for 2 months we had to work at a job, and I worked in a museum. And there I would just sit at my job whenever I had time and just chant. And I was looking for the temple. The address in the album was North Halsted Street, and the devotees weren't there anymore. And I called, not like today with the internet. You know, you call an operator and you ask, I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember this sort of thing. You call the operator and you ask, you know, I'm looking for the Radha Krishna temple. And I was just looking in Chicago, but the temple had moved to a suburb. So when she was looking in the Chicago directory, she didn't find it. She found an Indian man named Radha Krishna. You know, I called him and he said, oh, you want to come to my house? It's okay. Anyway, so I thought the temple was closed. And 2 weeks before I left, I ran into a brahmachari on the train named Yasumati Nandana, who now runs our center in Allahabad in India. And it turned out that I was living 2 blocks from the temple, but I was here and the temple was here and the train was here. So I would get on the train to go to work, and I would never go there and see them. So I saw him, and I said, oh, Hare Krishna, I'm looking for you guys. And he's one of these really staunch brahmacharis. You know, I'm a 17-year-old girl, okay? Hare Krishna, what to say? And he doesn't look at me, you know. Hare Krishna, you know you're from the temple.
Yes. Would you like to buy a magazine?
I said, I don't carry any money with me. I just carry money for a phone call.
He said, yeah, sure.
I said, no, really. And he says,
would you like to get in all the time? He's looking at the floor. I'm
thinking, this is a really strange guy, you know. He says,
would you like to come to the Sunday feast?
I said, I can't. I work on Sunday.
He says, yeah, sure.
Really friendly. Anyway, he gave me a little mantra card. So I went to the temple. And I had these big boots, tied up boots. So I didn't want to take my boots off. So I'm just standing by the doorway, and this one brahmachari there preached to me for about 1 or 2 hours. And I went there to buy some incense. And I remember him saying, why don't you just surrender? And I said, because I don't want to accept any authority. And he said, but you're already accepting so many authorities. And I thought, yeah, how does he know my secret? He sent him so many authorities. So I came back 2 days later, and I asked the temple president if I could stay there. And now temples won't let you stay there if you're underage, because 18 is legal age in America. But they didn't even ask that then. And he just said, you know, can you wake up early? And I said, I've always woken up early. And I was what I was really looking for was some way that I could be spiritual 24 hours a day. I didn't like the idea that you just go to a temple or a church or this or that once a week and you say a few prayers and then the rest of the time you're a materialist. I wanted to be absorbed in spirituality all the time. That's mostly what I was looking for. And at that time in university and working at a job, I wasn't very enthusiastic about anything the world had to offer. And I'd see everybody on the train going to work like this. And I think, yeah, you get a good career, and after 10, 15 years, you feel like they'll be the same way.
Oh, I gotta go to work.
It doesn't matter how interesting the career is. So I stayed overnight at the temple, and I went to one Mangalarti. I said, yeah, that's what I want to do. I said, I want to get up and sing and dance every morning instead of being on the train. Then I couldn't stay then. So I stayed for 2 weeks, and then I went back to university, and as soon as that year finished and I turned 18, then I went and moved back into the temple.
How did your parents feel about that?
Oh, yeah, my parents. Well, my mother was very upset, and it took my mother 10 years to... Which wasn't all her fault. A lot of that was my fault. I still see new devotees doing the sort of thing I did to my mother. If you're not going to talk about Krishna, I'm not having anything to do with you, you know. That didn't make her very pleased. My father was very supportive from the beginning. He said, I'm so glad you're looking for God. He said, when I was 18, I was looking for God, but I got distracted by business and family. And he said, I wish you'd do it in our own tradition, but that's not what's really important. What's important is you're looking for God. So he gave me the money to go to the Chicago Temple. Well, what happened was when a year of university was over, I started wearing saris and tilak to universities. Well, they weren't real saris. They were just pieces of cloth. But there weren't very many places you could buy saris in America at that time. There were hardly any Indians. And then I went back to my hometown, and I couldn't wear a sari in my hometown. I just couldn't do it. You know, so I put my blue jeans back on. And my mother starts saying, why don't you do this and that? And my friends start saying, why don't you do this and that? Do you really want to move into some temple? You know, again, no one knew Hare Krishna. And it was a Saturday. We were at lunch and we got the mail, and there was an invitation from the Chicago Temple, which is where I had stayed. That was the next day at 3 p.m. they were going to install Kishore Kishori. And I just felt like, you have to go now. That's it. If you don't go now, you're going to lose the chance. And I just looked at my parents. I said, I'm leaving tomorrow. So my father got me a round trip ticket. He said, do you want to come back? So I kept it for a while, and then I cashed it in. I can't do that kind of thing anymore. But I cashed the ticket in and bought a sleeping bag.
And then you've stayed in a temple ever since?
Well, not necessarily in a temple, but in ISKCON.
Yeah.
I almost didn't stay.
It can be a really fine line, can't it?
Well, when I moved in, then all of a sudden it was like I was in military boot camp. And my sisters were grown up when I was born. I was used to having my own space, and my parents were extremely wealthy. I mean, I was used to having, my bedroom was as big as this room, bigger than this room. And I could do whatever I wanted. And all of a sudden, I was being told, okay, it's 9 o'clock, you have to be polishing the brass and silver. Okay, it's 9:15, you've got to go work in the treasury office. Okay, it's 9:30, what's on your schedule for 9:30? You have to be making garlands. Okay, it's 10 o'clock, you've got to go out and book distribution. And every single minute of every day was regimented, and people were yelling at me all the time. You just went in the bathroom, you got to change all your clothes and take a shower before you even touch the flowers. I said, I just went to wash my hands in the bathroom. Why do I have to take a shower? So it was, you know.
But you stayed.
Well, yeah. Well, the first couple weeks, I was thinking, what am I doing here? You know, what did I do? I thought, maybe I'll just stay for the summer and then I'll go home. I couldn't handle it. Yeah. And I remember once making a comment and someone said, you're speculating. What do you think you know? You're not even initiated. How do you know anything? It was really intense.
Yeah.
I remember once going on book distribution and saying something about, you know, oh, I love Krishna. And one of the women said, you don't love Krishna. What am I doing here if I don't love Krishna? You know, it was very, very, very heavy. And I think it was two things. I was going out every day distributing books. I mean, I moved in the day Kishore Kishori were installed. The next day I was out on Harinam, and the next day I was out at the airport. It's kind of funny if you think about it. You know, here I was barely deciding whether I wanted to stay in the temple, hardly knew that God was a person, and I'm one of the frontline preachers and representatives of the Hare Krishna movement to the public. You know? Of course, we were really funny all together. We just wore polycotton pieces of cloth. And all the unmarried people wore saffron. And all the married people wore white or yellow. So the married ladies also wore it like that. You know, that was the married lady like that. So I was wearing just saffron cloth. It was really heavy cloth. And we were told the more pleats you had, the more chaste you were. So we had 25 pleats. I mean, really, just from here to here. And then the cloth was tucked in this much. I'm not joking. And it was real heavy. It was just dragging on the floor. And we had a border of gray dirt, you know. And then it was so heavy. So to keep it on your head, you had to have it pinned. We'd have a safety pin. It would kind of move up like this. And then we had these big nose rings. I mean, big. And it wasn't like today when piercing is fashionable, you know. So you have Tilak and this big nose ring and this sari up here. It wasn't a sari. And then we're just distributing back to Godheads, you know, running up to people. Would you like a book about love of God? Anyway, I was doing that every day. And I was encountering people in the airport from all over the world with all different philosophies, and I could defeat them all philosophically. So that really convinced me. I mean, I didn't even know the philosophy. Not that I know it now, but I mean, I didn't even know the philosophy. Nothing. And still, I could defeat anybody with any argument. So that was pretty amazing. And then also at the end of the 2 weeks, I started to get very attached to the deities. So after 2 weeks, I said, okay, I'm going to stay. But the first 2 weeks were really hard on my false ego. You're foolish, you don't know anything, just do what you're told, and here's 150 new rules you have to follow today.
And then you meet Prabhupada?
I didn't meet Prabhupada till the next summer. Your winter.
Now what?
Your winter. By the time I met Prabhupada, I was already initiated.
Oh, okay.
I didn't even ask to get initiated. The temple president just came up to me one day and said, so Prabhupada's accepted you as his disciple. Well, okay.
Wow.
That's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, people have stranger stories than that.
So how did that work? Did he speak to Prabhupada?
He just sent a letter. Because I got married, I moved in June, and I got married in October. And I married a very senior devotee who'd been in the movement for about 3 years. And he was already second initiated, and the temple president thought, well, if you're going to marry someone who's already second initiated, you should get initiated. So, you know, he just wrote a letter to Srila Prabhupada recommending devotees, and Prabhupada wrote back and said, I accepted you.
So it was a natural thing to just go ahead and... So how did the initiation happen?
Well, it was done by the temple president.
Oh, okay.
So most of us got initiated like that through the mail. Second initiation I got personally from Prabhupada. That's a whole other story, but it's getting late. And I'm tired.
We could do another one.
No, we're not doing another.
We could do a pilot one.
No, it's okay. Then you're going to ask me to tell all my Prabhupada stories.
They should be told.
Well, I told them all in Trinidad, and they were recorded there many years ago.
Okay.
But I have a lot of nice Prabhupada stories. Prabhupada in the airport with flowers, and...
So maybe we'll come and see one day.
Maybe someday, yeah. Maybe a few months from now, maybe. Yeah. You can ask me, then we'll come and I'll tell my Prabhupada stories.
Okay, thank you.
All right?
Great.
Is that okay?
It's nice to hear how devotees come, isn't it?
Was that all right?
It was very nice.
I know. I think, you know, it'd be much more interesting to listen to Krishna's pastimes or Prabhupada's pastimes.
What about the devotees?
That would be a good idea, to listen to the pastimes about the devotees. So is there anything else that you'd particularly like to know?
Did Prabhupada explain your name when he gave it to you, or he just got it?
No.
Your name is... Okay, who's that?
Well... Also, we didn't even know how to pronounce it. So we thought it was Ermelia. You know, and then the Indians are coming to the temple, what's your name? Ermelia. I'm like, what? So you write it down and they go, oh, Urmila, oh. My sister is Urmila, my mother is Urmila, oh, very nice name. And Garuda told me that he thought his name was Guru Das Das. His papa said Garuda Das, and there was a devotee named Guru Das, and Garuda thought his name was Guru Das Das. So he thought it was his sermon of Guru Das.
Must have been hard in those days because it was a complete new culture, isn't it?
Yeah, but we were young.
Yeah.
But we were young, and I don't know. When you're young, it's fun to be outrageous.
You
Seriously. You don't think that much about it, going out on the street in a saffron piece of cloth. You know. I had one nose ring that was this big. I had to have a chain to my ear to keep it from flopping around. So it's just fun. And also, we thought we were going to take over the whole world very soon. We didn't have much of a concrete plan. My mother would say, okay, you're selling your books so people will move into your temples. And then they go out and sell more books so more people will move into your temples. She said, you can't have the whole world move into your temple. She said, what is your plan? And I just thought, oh, you're just Carmi. So it wasn't a very clear idea. Something about Varnashram and farms or something, you know? And it's just going to happen. We're just going to go out and sell Bhagavad Gita's and, tomorrow everybody's going to be chanting Hare Krishna. So when you're thinking like that, it's pretty easy.
Non-fiction.
Yeah, it was nice. That was nice. And also when you're young, I think it's a lot easier to do things like live in a room with 12 other people and have no possessions and just travel around. And you don't think about what's going to happen if I get sick and what will happen if I get old. And those things don't even cross your mind. It's just, you sort of think you're immortal and invulnerable. And it's a lot easier to do heavy austerity. It's just fun. And it was not fun.
Great. Any more questions? I know Mother Emily has to go to bed because she's
exhausted. Well, I've got to. Well, mostly it's because I still got to do this thing for the school. See, originally I thought I had till next Saturday to get it done, but now I have to get it done by Tuesday. So, putting in a lot of hours. Is there anything else anybody would like to ask me? Yes?
Is it any family members, they are in Krishna consciousness, since everybody knows you were like father, mother, sisters?
My mother, father, and both my sisters have all died. My father became a life member. The same day that I got Gayatri Mantra, my father gave Prabhupada the check for life membership. And he was practicing Krishna consciousness maybe for about a year and a half or 2 years. But then he had separated from my mother. He was really living like a renunciate. And then he got remarried, and his second wife she kind of gradually took him in another direction. But he always remained very favorable. He almost been me about a year and a half, 2 years. He wasn't never chanting 16 rounds. I remember the first time he was chanting after 20 minutes, he said, I finished one round. I think that had there been older people in ISKCON, he probably would have fully joined. But he was already, my parents were older when I was born. As I said, my sisters got, when I was 2 and 3, my sisters got married. So by the time I joined the movement, my father was already in his 60s. And, everyone in the temple was pretty much under 30. There might be one person in the temple that was 32 years old. And I know Bhaktivedanta Swami used to say, people want to see somebody like themselves. It's very, very difficult to make, you're 63 years old. So I think that was a really big problem. I mean, had the movement been what it's like today, I think he might very well have joined. My sister's husband, she's now passed away, he's remarried, the one who met Prabhupada, he's kind of a Hindu. He's not a Hare Krishna devotee, but he's a Hindu. And he's certainly very open and favorable. He's visited me many times at the temple, and he spent a lot of time in India. And their daughter is also very favorable, but she's more also like she's much more like a Hindu. I don't know, white Hindus. Have you met white Hindus? Do you understand what I'm talking about? They have an altar with Shiva and Ganesh and Krishna and the whole thing. Yeah, everybody. It's becoming much more common that you find non-Indian Hindus. When I went to give a class at the college here, where Rukmini goes to school, the Ayurvedic college, and most of the people there were Westerners, and they said, how did you decide to worship Krishna instead of Shiva or Ganesh? And it was such an odd question, because I hadn't even heard of Shiva or Ganesh. You know, it wasn't like I had a was thinking like that. But so my brother-in-law is more like that. But I didn't keep up much with my family. We had a mood in those days of cutting off relationships with your family. So I didn't talk to them much or see them very much. I think, you know, not that I have any regrets, but I don't think that's such a good idea. When my mother was dying, some of my cousins were very interested in Krishna consciousness and asking me a lot of questions. One of them asked me for a book. But I really hadn't kept up any kind of relationship with them. You know, we were really like we're devotees and they're karmis, kind of
stuff. It's really evolving now,
isn't it? Yeah, well, just like we're looking tomorrow at Nectar of Instruction texts 4, 5, and 6, and we're Prabhupada saying how you shouldn't engage in these 6 loving exchanges with materialists or impersonalists, and we took that really very seriously and very literally, that we shouldn't have any kinds of social dealings with anyone who wasn't a devotee, even if they were our family members. It was, like I said, it took my mother 10 years. It took her 8 years before she was pleasant about Krishna consciousness, and another 2 years before I could really have any kind of a reasonable dealing with her. But again, we did that as much as they did by our, you know, this is just the way it is, and you have to.
That's youth, right?
It's youth, but it's also just a typical fanaticism that comes from your own lack of faith and your own lack of commitment that you're not honest about. Your own strong material desires. You really only have this much faith, and your material desires are really this big, and you can't really deal with that. So you just pretend that your material desires are this big and your faith is this big, and you do that by being very... You put up this wall. So you can't see yourself honestly, and nor can you relate to other people in a very honest manner. But it's often necessary in the beginning, otherwise you can't function. If in the beginning you really saw how degraded you were and how little faith you had, you wouldn't be able to go on. So it's a... Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur calls this false confidence, where you think, yes, you know, I'm very spiritual. And it's... seems to just be part and parcel of the program. I've noticed that the children who grow up in the Hare Krishna movement, if they're brought up strictly, don't do that. They don't go through this heavy phase at all. They have a completely different psychology. But most people do. I mean, I see people do it now. It doesn't matter whether they come when they're 18 or 20 or 30. But the majority of people go through this sort of, yes, I'm very Krishna conscious, and you're not, kind of thing. Is there anything else?
But you live with your personal life, your family, how many children?
We have 3 children. My oldest son is 34. He's married, and they're disciples of Satsukh Maharaj. They have 4 sons and 3 daughters. They live in Hawaii. They homeschool their kids. Then I have a daughter who's 30. She's married. She and her husband are initiated by Bir Krishna Swami. They have one daughter who they homeschool, and then I have a son who's 27, and he's going to get married in May. And right now they all live in America. And my oldest son is a computer programmer, and my son-in-law is a property manager, and my youngest son runs a prasadam business where they make the health food bars. And my husband lives in America, and he does some preaching over the internet. We have a reverse, you see. Instead of I stay home and the husband travels, he stays and I travel. Modern. Like these house husbands. You know? So. Now, we decided a long time ago that we weren't going to be the travel together as Vanaprastha. When we asked, when we were in India in 86, and we were traveling around India, and we looked at each other and said, you know, we're not going to travel together as Vanaprasthas. So we've been Vanaprasthas for now about 13 years. I haven't yet spent a night in the Vana, though. Usually I have a genuine roof over my head. The real Vanaprastha is supposed to just keep the roof for the sacred fire and live outside. Maybe one day Hari Priya will kick me out and then I'll have to live outside. With the pukikos and the cats. Is there anything else?
Thank you. We will
eat. You're welcome. I was thinking, yeah, you should have just asked me for my Prabhupada stories. That would have been more interesting.
No, this is very interesting.
So maybe another time. I will tell. All right, thank you. I hope this was of some value to you. All right.